We begin this morning with this strange miracle, which is the only miracle to be done in two stages recorded in the Gospels. Jesus gets out of a boat at this little town, a village of Bethsaida, and the blind man is brought to Jesus. Jesus takes him outside of the village, perhaps away from unwanted attention. Jesus spits on the man's eyes and puts his hands on him, and he asks a question. Verse 23, "Do you see anything?" The man looks up. He said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." In other words, his sight is coming back to him, but he has blurred vision. A bit like me, actually. If I took off my glasses now, I have absolutely sort of rotten sight. And if you were to stand up and start walking around, you would look like trees walking around. Some of you are slightly more like willow trees and one or two oaks amongst you, but you would look like trees. Now, Jesus then puts his hands back on the man and says, verse 24, Jesus put his hands on the man. And then we're told, verse 25, his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, he saw everything clearly. It is an astonishing thing that Jesus has done for him. And it is a pivotal moment in this man's life. He had been blind, and now he can see. And here is the breathtaking ability of Jesus to put back together the broken pieces of this world so that they are restored to be as they ought to be. And when Jesus returns to this earth and brings in the kingdom of God in fullness, do you think it will be a happy day for those with ailing bodies such as ourselves? It will be, for that which is broken will be put right forevermore. This man's eyes were opened. But what of the two-stage process? Jesus has never lacked power previously in the Gospels, and it seems odd for him, therefore, to take two attempts at him. And the answer seems to lie in the double meaning of this word sight. There is a physical healing going on here, but as so often with Jesus, Jesus uses sight as a metaphor for whether people can see spiritually. Because we live in two worlds at the same time. A physical world, which anyone with physical sight is able to see in front of them, and a spiritual world to which we are all naturally blind. And certainly the disciples have been blind. If you were here a couple of weeks ago, and you'll remember that discussion after the feeding of the 4,000, when Jesus warned the disciples of the yeast of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And the disciples scratched their heads. What's he talking about? Is he saying this because we don't have enough bread? And they're operating on the physical world. They seem to be blind to the spiritual world, which Jesus is talking about. He's warning them against the unbelief of the leaders of the synagogues of the day. And the disciples couldn't understand that. Well, here with this man, Jesus shows himself to be the great sight giver. And the disciples will need that sight, because at best, they are only halfway. They have very blurry vision, as we're about to see in the rest of the passage. And so in verse 27, Jesus continues on his preaching tour. And on the way, he asks his disciples a question. It's often said, isn't it, that you can tell more about someone by the questions they ask than the answers that they give. And Jesus was a great asker of questions. And here is one of the best, verse 27. "Who do people say that I am?" Well, they give some answers. Jesus, some people say John the Baptist. And others are saying you're the great prophet Elijah. And still others are one of the rest of the field. And it's true, isn't it, that people do have an astonishingly wide range of views as to who Jesus is. In fact, just in this last week, I've asked two different people, tell me, who do you think Jesus is? One person said, "I think he was a normal person." I said, "Do you mean completely normal, just like everyone else?" "Yes, I do," they said. I asked someone else, "Who do you think Jesus is?" They said, "I think he was the Son of God." "Really?" I said. "I really do," they said. Now, how can you think two things so poles apart of the same person, completely just like everyone else, and the Son of God? That is quite a range of views. And if we were to survey people within Christchurch or across the country, no doubt we would find every other position between those two would fit in along the line. Now, Jesus then has a follow-up question, verse 29. "But what about you?" he asked. Who do you say that I am? It's the same question, except it's not, because it's a totally different question. Yes, that's what other people think, but what about you? Who do you say that I am? Jesus says. In other words, what about you? Don't worry about other people. What about you? After we, Teresa and I came to New Zealand in 2005, within a month there was a general election here. And I remember asking a few people, well, who do people vote for in this country? What are the sort of main parties or what do they stand for? And you might have told me, oh, there's Labour and there's National and there's Greens and there's this, that and the other, and these are the options. If I turned to you and said, yeah, but who do you vote for? It's suddenly a much more personal, what, me? Yes, you. Who do you vote for? And that's what Jesus is asking here. What about you? Who do you say that I am? For at the end of the day, here is the question that none of us can avoid forever. We can put it off for a time, but one day we will have to give an answer to it. For Jesus himself declares himself to be the living God, before whom each of us must stand. His followers thought that he was the living God, and he was put to death because his enemies realized that he was saying that he was the living God, and they considered such words to be blasphemous. Moreover, we might point to the fact that his life provides the evidence for who he is. Who else do we know that can tell people they are forgiven by God and then can heal them in a word from a lifelong disease? Who else do we know that can just calm a raging storm with a single word? Who can make a deaf man hear? Who can make a blind man see? And who can cure a medically incurable condition that we normally call death? And raise a little girl from the dead. Who else has fulfilled the promises of the Old Testament? Only one person. The evidence is right before our eyes as to who he is. And no wonder in his book, The God Delusion, Richard Dawkins only has 2 pages looking into Jesus. No wonder, for it is very hard to argue against this weight of hard evidence. And Peter is persuaded. He says, you are the Christ. That is, you are the divine king that God has sent to rule this world and to save his people. I believe you, Jesus. I am one of yours. You are the Christ. Which meets with this rather strange response in verse 30. Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about it. Seems odd. Doesn't Jesus want to take advantage of a bit of free publicity when the opportunity is there? But Jesus knows better. And he knows that to have someone who is preaching error is worse than to have someone not speaking at all. And he doesn't want them to teach about him when they don't yet know what they are speaking of. And that becomes clear in the second half of the passage. For now he moves on to explaining why he came. Verse 31, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. For in Peter's mind, it wasn't possible to be God's Christ and to be put to death like this. It was no surprise to Peter that the Christ would rise from the dead. The surprise was that he would be put to death. And how can you achieve that? How can you bring in the fulfillment of God's kingdom through that? I mean, normally, we wouldn't think that you could achieve anything by dying, and certainly Peter doesn't think so. And so Jesus responds in kind with a rebuke of his own in verse 33. Have a look down. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. Get behind me, Satan, he said. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men. Jesus spots straight away this thinking must have come from below, must have come from the evil one. For any thinking which tries to avoid the cross is satanic. After all, the cross would be God's way of absorbing people's sins. The cross would be God's way of reversing the effects of the fall. The cross would be God's way of bringing guilty people like us to himself. And the cross would be God's way of defeating Satan forevermore. And so to tempt Jesus into thinking the cross would not be necessary, that he should not die, in Jesus' mind was nothing less than satanic. But from our point of view, what it really shows is that Peter hadn't actually understood who Jesus was at all. He had kind of understood, you are the Christ. But his understanding was so deficient as to what it means to be the Christ that you couldn't really say his sight was any more than a blurry vision. And Jesus, therefore, in verse 34 onwards, goes on to explain that to follow this Christ means to walk in the way that he himself walked, which is to his death. That is, you only show your understanding of who Jesus is, who he really is, by the life that you then lead. And if our lives don't really point to a life of self-sacrifice in the way that Jesus is about to point out, it shows that we haven't understood that Jesus was all about self-sacrifice, that he came to lay down his life for others. And so let's have a look at what he says about the Christian life. He calls the crowd in verse 34 and he issues an invitation. It is a great invitation, for it is an invitation to follow the greatest person this world has ever known. It's a personal invitation, for Jesus is giving it to people who are standing in front of him, just as he gives it to each of us who are here this morning. And it is a generous invitation, for it is thrown out to anyone, to everyone, everywhere. Verse 34, Jesus called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, if anyone would come after me, no matter what country you're from, no matter what your background, no matter what kind of life you've led, if anyone would come after me. And then he shows what is required. First of all, there is a cost. Verse 34, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. When Jesus says that a person must deny himself, what he is saying is that when a person comes to Christ and follows him, they need to accept the principle, it's a non-negotiable, that they are dying to themselves, that they are giving up on themselves and their right to rule their own lives. They are saying, I know and I admit that I have sinned, and from now on I'm taking my hands off the wheel and I'm letting you drive the car. I'm fundamentally stepping down from the position of running my own life. And that, after all, was the same way that Jesus lived his life. Because his life was a life of dying to self and allowing his heavenly Father to call the shots. He says that in verse 31 when he says the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected and must be killed. He is speaking here of the life of sacrifice which was his. His life was not his own to do as he wanted, but was his heavenly Father's for him to obey and do as his Father wanted. Not my will, but yours be done. And therefore, to walk in Jesus' footsteps means to accept the same principle. And accepting the same principle in one direction means inevitably saying no in another direction. To accept him as the Lord of my life over here means admitting that I am no longer the Lord of my life over here. To say yes to him over here means to say no to myself over here. Or to put it in other words, when a person becomes a Christian, they go to a funeral. Their own. Because that is what is happening when you come to put your faith in Jesus. You are saying, my life is no longer my life. My body is no longer my body. My possessions are no longer my possessions. My time is no longer my time. Everything I have is yours. Me, everything I own, everything I am. And I think this is why some people get into trouble in the Christian life. The Christian life is always difficult, and I don't want to play down that. But it becomes very, very, very difficult if you try to live it without having first put yourself to death over here. If you are the same person that you always were, and you like the idea of following Jesus, you will always then have a conflict of interest. Because you will be saying, I want to live Jesus' way, and I also want to live my way at the same time. I want to do what Jesus wants with my life and find out what God's plan is for my life. And I also have no intention of the life that I already cling on to. It becomes so difficult. It means that Maybe we'll do what's asked of us. But that's not the same thing as volunteering. It may mean that we are dutiful, but that's not the same thing as being joyful. It may mean that we are faithful, but that's not the same thing as being willing. It may mean that we give, but that's not the same thing as being generous. And if Christianity is a bolt onto my life, the life that I've always lived, I never, ever will be able to follow Christ, as he says, any who come after him must do. For the only way to follow Christ is to give up on our lives, to say, I have no rights, to give up on our rights. I no longer have a right to a certain standard of living. I no longer have a right to a certain standard of health. My body is his. I no longer have a right to a certain standard of life. And maybe for some of us here, we've kind of set off down the road of Christian discipleship without ever having taken this first fundamental step. And we need to actually come back to the beginning. For truth is, we may not be walking on the road which is actually Jesus' road. And as long as I'm saying, oh, I'm happy to give up some things and keep control of my life, Jesus is saying, you are no disciple of mine. For there is only one way to follow him, and that way is to give up our lives. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself. And he must take up his cross. In the ancient world, to take up a cross meant to go to one's death. And so this speaks of the extent to which we are to follow Christ. That is, it's not possible to follow Jesus on a casual basis. If you follow me at all, says Jesus, you follow me to your death. For Jesus only knows one kind of follower, the one who gives up everything for him. He's not interested in sitting on the mantelpiece of our lives. He's not interested in just having a walk-on part one day a week in our lives. As it's sometimes said, true enough, the entrance fee into heaven is free. It really is. It's totally free. We don't contribute anything to it. It's given to us on a plate through the kindness and generosity of God our Saviour, who gave his one and only Son to die for us. The entrance fee is free, but the annual subscription is everything. For everything we have belongs to him. We belong to him. And for the person who follows him, there is no other way. I want to suggest two ways that this particularly applies to us in our culture. The first is, it will change our attitude to people. I think if you would ask me before I became a Christian, James, if you become a Christian, what will change in your life? I would have been able to point out a couple of things which are fairly sort of glaring errors. But I don't think it would have occurred to me to say that treatment of people would be one of those things. And particularly, treatment of God's people. For God has a special interest in how his people are looked after, in how his people are treated. And we need to ask of ourselves, do they matter to us? Do other Christians matter to us? Do people generally matter to us? That will affect, of course, whether we have time for them, whether we have time to encourage Christians in their life, and whether we have time to build relationships with others, to be able to love them and to seek to win them for Christ. Our attitude to each other and to welcoming those around us, it speaks volumes, absolute volumes, for whether our own interests have been put to death. Because if our own interests haven't been put to death, I'll always say, I haven't really got time. Oh, sorry, I'm just a bit shy. I can't do that. Whereas when we follow Christ, we realise we have to put ourselves out of our comfort zones for the good of other people, just as Jesus put himself well out of his comfort zone for our good. The other area is our attitude to money. Naturally, I think my money is my own. Well, I earned it, so it must be mine. And it comes as a great shock and possibly a great wrench to acknowledge it is not my own. Now, I want to say a word on this because it is a word for our culture in our times, that here is the number one idol. And I know we don't call it an idol. We just talk about sort of the house I want to buy or the standard of living I want or, you know, my holiday, whatever. But dollar signs are sort of what it comes down to in the end. Now, last week I revealed the state of the church finances, which I don't want to overblow in the sense that They have been carefully managed and prudently managed. But on the other hand, if you were here last week and you saw the size of the deficits looming in front of us, which grow to nearly 200,000 in 2 years' time, whether it was 200 years' time, in 2 years' time, then you might think in the light of that I have manipulated things here to choose a kind of passage which might speak to that subject. And it is true, we probably will have a series on money at some point next year. But, as you know, we've been working through Mark, and this just happens to be the passage that is in front of us today. And therefore one might take the view that in God's providence, this is a word that has been supplied by God for our benefit. You see, you could take the view that with a number of different things coming up in church life, if we're going to go this much into a debt or be in this much deficit, you could say, is this really worth it? We don't really have the money. But the truth is, when you think about it, we do have the money. And that's a wonderful thing. God has given us the money. We don't have to go out and look for it, for we have it. I did a rough calculation, very rough, but in the millions of dollars of annual income that we have as a church together, not to get any one individual, but us together as a church, and in the tens of millions of dollars of assets that we hold as people together, as a church, the figures are enormous, even when you do them on the back of an envelope, give or take the odd naught. We have more money than we are willing and probably able to count between us as a whole church. And the truth is that we could knock the church deficit on the head almost overnight. In fact, I put it to you that if each of us gave 5% of our income plus the tax rebate, we would be looking for new ministries to start up. We wouldn't be talking in terms of deficits. Although, of course, even to speak in those terms isn't quite right, because we want to give as much as we can to the gospel work. Not as much that as much as doesn't disturb our current lifestyle. And the real question, and I speak to myself and to no one in particular, just for us as a church, is whether we are willing to lay our wallets before Jesus. Or maybe, to put it better, whether we are willing to lay our hearts before Jesus. For in the end, the test of our wallet is really the test of our heart. And what matters to us. Now, Jesus is talking here in big bickies. And not just financially. In every way. To give up one's life, you don't do it lightly. You don't do it just sort of on the way to the shop, sort of because you can't think of anything else to do. This is a serious thing he is speaking of. He is talking here about the rest of your life and the rest of eternity. And Jesus knows that we need a pretty substantial motivation to push ahead with this. And so, as the master psychologist, he provides us that in verse 35, where he gives us the reason. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. Whoever wants to save his life, he says, will lose it. That is, if I insist on maintaining the right to control my life, then good luck to you, says Jesus, for at the end of time, when you stand before me, you will lose it. You will lose it forevermore. You will lose your life as you enter the pit of destruction, to have all eternity to reflect on the fact that you would not give up your life to the God who made you. On the other hand, Jesus says, if you take that painful step of relinquishing your life, and allow him to take control of it, you will just have gained it. You will have gained it forevermore. For he will give it back to you. Your life will be saved. As if that was not enough, he then pushes on in verse 36. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul? Jesus is helping us to see here that the worst thing that can happen to us is for us to forfeit our soul. For your soul is you. You, the person you that God has made you. There is nothing worse in this life than to lose yourself. And Jesus is saying, what good would it be
to gain the whole world, to gain everything. I mean, just imagine for a second you could do that. Of course, he's speaking hyperbole here, or possibility. But just suppose, you know, the gold bullion of Fort Knox is yours, and the enormous sort of telephone salaries, you say, as some sort of chief executive of some sort of multinational, that's yours. And in fact, you own the whole country. In fact, Jesus said, you own the whole world. I don't know if you ever saw that American basketball player, Shaq O'Neal. I think he's now retired, isn't he? 7'1" and 150 kilos, earning $30 million a year. And on his arm, the tattoo, the world is mine. Brilliant. And he's a humble man at the same time. Now, just suppose, you know, the whole world is ours or is yours. Jesus says, would that be a good deal if you lost your soul at the end of time? Which would you rather have? Jesus says, it's madness. It's madness to opt for that kind of short-termist view. You have to know which side your bread is buttered. And so we hold on to our lives at our peril. We are so stubbornly independent. We are so desperately and sinfully reluctant to hand over us and everything we have to Jesus, not trusting that he is so good, so kind. Here is the one person we actually can entrust ourselves to. Jesus is trying to get us to see what matters, what is important in life. What can a man give in exchange for his soul? There is nothing, nothing more important in this world and in eternity for you than yourself and your soul. And Jesus would urge us this morning, therefore, to surrender. And I would urge you to do the same. Even if you can gain the whole riches of this whole world, even if you can gain the whole authority of this whole world, or as he goes on to say in verse 38, even if you could gain the respect of this whole world. For verse 38 is the specific example that he gives. And in verse 38 he says, if anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. It's really a specific application of the general theme. Jesus is saying, look, if you want to be popular, if you want to gain respect from people, and you always want to be respected, if you want tons of people to come to your funeral when you've finally fallen off the perch, then you're done for. But if you're happy to be ashamed, if you're happy to live a life of shame, of following Jesus, then there is hope for you yet. And there is shame. Think of those disciples living in that culture. You're what? You're worshipping a criminal as your God? But then it's not so different today, is it? What? Jesus? Mary's got religious in that way? Begun to follow Jesus? It's the shame that comes from a person that lives a radical life where people can't understand why they do it. Just are not able to understand it. Jesus says, beware if that is your temptation. If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, I will be ashamed of him when I come in my Father's glory with the holy angels. And to prove it, in verse 1 of chapter 9, he says that some standing there would not see death before he comes. And the transfiguration follows, where Jesus is lighted up in white, showing to his disciples that though he would shortly die, he is in fact the King overall. So to conclude, we finish where we began with the blind man, healed in two stages, showing that the disciples, they could understand some things, they could see some things, but their spiritual sight is just blurry vision. They're able to understand that Jesus is the Christ, not able to understand that to be the Christ means to die, and to follow him means to die, which is why two chapters later they're still arguing about who is the greatest. They've not understood that to follow Jesus means to put your life to death. Well, that was them back then. Question is, what about us now? What about you? If I was to ask people at St. John's who Jesus is, I would expect that 95% of people would say the Son of God and believe it. And if you're in the other 5% and you're not sure, then I want to say it is wonderful to have you with us, and you're in the right place. I hope you can come to the carol services, because it is a great chance to think about who Jesus is and to consider that more fully. And they're good fun as well.
I hope you'll be back for those. But if we were to think, have we understood the second part, that our lives are not our lives, that our attitude to people is not something which I can pick and choose, that my money is not my own, maybe some of us would begin to feel more uncomfortable. And it may be for some of us that we have not really understood that Jesus is the Christ who will die, and that to follow him means to die as well. In the end, if we've not understood that, we have not actually begun the journey with Jesus. And we need to go back to the beginning. Even if we think we've been Christians for years, we need to go back to the beginning. For the beginning is actually the entranceway to the light of life and to an eternity with Christ. I want to finish with the story of the returning missionary, because this seems to me to capture what Jesus is speaking of here. And this godly woman was interviewed in church, having been away for many, many years and come back at retirement age. And she spoke at the front of all that she had seen God do and the amazing things that she had witnessed while she had been abroad. And the congregation was absolutely goggle-eyed as they heard what she'd been, what she'd seen over these years that she'd been away. There was one boy up there, young lad up the front, who was particularly gobsmacked. And afterwards, over morning tea, he spoke to a friend. He said, "Wow, was it amazing what that woman was speaking about?" He said, "I'd give everything to have a testimony like that." And the lady heard him and turned around and said, "Young man, everything is what it costs me." And that's really what Jesus would say to us. You can't follow him without it costing everything. And anything less is not worshipping the Christ who died.